Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today will mark a decade of USU's Farm in Literature and Culture course. The class seeks to identify agriculture and literary themes that cut across human history and culture. The course also focuses on music and literature. And our guests include USU lecturers and professors who, and a USU student who says the class has had a continuing influence in her life. So the Farm in Literature and Culture team consists of lecturers Bonnie Moore, Rosa Thornley, and Deanna Allred. Emily Folsom is an undergraduate student who took the Farm and Literature course and quickly connected with the content in a deeply personal manner. And we'll also be talking with USU Associate Professor of Folklore, Lynn McNeil. So let's meet our guests today. Bonnie Moore is with us. So I understand you joined USU's English Department as a lecturer in 2012, teaching full-time since then. What kinds of courses have you taught?
So I teach mainly English 2010, which is writing, but I've taught 18 sections since 2014 of the Farm in Lit and Culture, and have had just enjoyed it so much. The students just connect with it immediately and see the importance of it, and it's just been a joy to work with them.
So I understand you help them to understand their own relationship with agriculture.
Yes, so they all do an essay where they trace their own farming roots, because eventually we all go back to farming. Mm. And I've taught students from China and from South America, and it doesn't matter where they're from. Everyone goes back to farming because that's the basis of everything, really.
And for most of us, you don't have to go back too far.
Nope. Yeah. I'm a first generation. I grew up with a beet hoe in my hand and hoeing hay.
Right. So beet hoe, is that Idaho?
That's Utah.
Utah.
Yeah.
So,
near Richfield, center of the state.
Nice, yeah. You were just with several others, including Lynn McNeil, at the Western Literature Association Conference. A panel entitled The Farm, Idaho Writers, Landscape, and Indigenous Implications.
Yes, that was a really great experience that we had. Right, Lynn?
Oh, it was amazing.
It was amazing. And we had a chance to talk mainly about Braiding Sweetgrass, which is a text that actually Deanna introduced me to, and it's been transformative for the students in the course.
Yeah. Robin Wall Kimmerer, right? I had a chance to interview her. So what a wonderful opportunity. So, Bonnie Moore, you're interested in Willa Cather.
I am. I'm a Cather fan, and that's how I got connected with Evelyn Funda and took her class, her first class, actually. I didn't know that until I got a little history of the class from her, and she started teaching it with a reader in 2008, and I was actually in that section, and so she kind of brought me up in Farm Lit.
Yeah, and of course, Cather, a lot of connections there, right?
Yes, because she is a Cather scholar, and I love Cather and had already read all of her works before I came to grad school, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's your favorite?
My favorite by far is My Antonia.
My Antonia, okay. Yep. Yeah. I understand you work with the Mormon studies, particularly study of early Mormon women who practiced polygamy.
Yeah, so I wrote my thesis about my great-grandmother, who was a polygamous woman, a second wife, and how she pushed back against all the norms of the day using mainly humor and action to get her way in a pretty male-dominated culture.
Oh, so, interesting, yeah. Yeah, that's great. And you work with concurrent enrollment high school teachers, Roosevelt, Price, and Vernal.
Right. I actually asked for some rural high schools to work with because I grew up in a rural high school in Richfield, Utah, and so I have a lot of compassion and feeling for the rural people, and so I wanted to work with those teachers, and I just have to say they are amazing. Mm-hmm. The ones I worked with, they're doing a great job.
Yeah. Well, I went to high school in Yonah High in Vernal, so concurrent enrollment.
Yes.
And I had some great teachers, so yes. I can second that. Let's see. Let's welcome in Rosa Thornley.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. So you were involved with the Farm, a multimodal reader?
Yes. When
you'd pull your microphone up just a little bit.
You bet. Yeah,
there you go.
When Joyce and Evelyn and Lynn started to pull different ideas together for this reader, they actually came to Bonnie and I and asked if we had any ideas to contribute. I, at the time, as a graduate student, I was studying a lot of quilt making, and so we talked about the quilt makers of G's Bend, because although literature really is a reflection of human experience, we have a lot of cultures who do not have the written language. And so that's what was represented in the quilt makers of G-Spend. And so Evelyn and I worked together by gathering information to make that a section of the reader. And I think it really contributes, I think Lynn can speak to this, that it balances out that idea of literature and the human experience, and then how do we bring in other things like quilt making or Negro spirituals, that type of thing that represent farm in those cultures.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. That's interesting, Lynn. These other things that you wouldn't, I guess, necessarily connect.
Yeah, I think when we think literature, we think of texts, we think of publications, we think of the written word. And that's what students go into this expecting for the most part. And I think what they end up finding is not just that larger connection beyond literature, but their own connection. And whether that's their family lineage and how recently or distant they can trace a farm in their own past, but also just the world around them having all of these little embedded elements of agriculture, of farming, in ways that are so background that you don't notice it until these classes with these instructors bring them into the foreground, and suddenly you're catching jokes and the farmers market posters and sort of these ways that agriculture informs our daily existence that it's really easy to overlook. And then this class swoops in and says, you're not going to overlook it anymore.
Well, mm-hmm. And I have students that do that when we do our farm unit. Or folklore unit, excuse me. I invite them to bring in, after they read a section of Lynn's book, Folklore Matters, I invite them to bring in their own examples. And so we end up with oral histories of grandparents. There's always recipes. They talk about canning. The one that I loved the most that one of them brought in the other day was they called the blood circle, that their grandpa taught them to take their axe and draw a circle around where they were chopping wood so that nobody would walk into that circle and get hurt.
Yeah.
But they realize folklore isn't everything, but when they recognize that they were surrounded by it, then it's easier for them to identify it.
Yeah, on a personal level, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Connect to it. So I understand you've developed a new professional communications course, Literature by Women.
They're actually two different courses.
Two different courses.
Professional communications.
And literature by women.
Yes, and okay. Literature by women. Yeah. Professional communications is one of our department's new offerings. It is what we called a communication literacy 2 level, and so students have the choice of taking that and or English 2010, excuse me. A lot of students are really engaged with that because they have the opportunity to research the genres that are specific to the disciplines that they are studying in. They learn to identify the stakeholders, and so it helps them to really narrow down who their audience is. They can identify specific audiences. The literature by women that I've taught for a couple of summers was one that really focused on not only literature by women, but what it contributed to different aspects of what we associate with female that have to do with maybe being silenced or perhaps. Emily is nodding. Did you take that class, Emily?
I did. I took it, I want to say, 2 summers ago.
Yes.
But I did take that class.
Mm. Tell me about that, Emily.
So the biggest thing I remember doing is we did this, like, comparison essay. It was like read a piece by, I read Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, and then I compared it to, there's like a 2005-2004 movie adaptation, and it was, I've always loved Jane Austen, but it was really interesting because you saw ways in which she pushed norms. She was sarcastic, she was witty, and at that time it's like, that's a man's job. You can't do that. So it was very eye-opening for me to take the course, especially at this age where I had been studying English and it was mostly by men, to see a strong, powerful woman in literature.
So Austen's, I guess, humor, that Satire was seen as a province of men.
Yeah, and the satire really was, the genre itself is pushing against the norms, and so it was very cool to see a woman using it.
Yeah. I especially love Austin's periodic hypochondriacs.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And persuasion, right? The sister is sick when she wants to be, but then...
And same with the mother. She, the mother, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the fathers in her novels get progressively worse until you hit Persuasion, and he's just awful. Yeah. Anyway, we could do a whole show on Austin.
We should.
So Rosa Thornley, you're apparently working with Folklore Institute of Iceland.
Yes.
Tell me about that. And a field trip coming up. Do you need a radio guy to go with you?
So many people say try and work their way into that study abroad. I actually lived in Iceland. COVID wasn't as negative an impact on me as others because I was living in Iceland at the time. And while I was there, because of my degree in American Studies and Folklore, I have developed that lens for folklore. I love handcrafts. I went in thinking I'm going to learn to knit, I'm going to learn to make yarn, all of those good things. But every time we traveled throughout the country, I noticed, again, this came from teaching farm for almost a decade, that there were these pens that they always looked similar in shape, no matter what material they were made out of. And they call them rétir. And I have to divide it out because there is actually a roundup in the fall when they bring all the sheep together that they also call that rétir. But the shape of the, what I'll call sheep pen, that's probably the easiest thing to compare it to that we would think of it, is that they don't have any private grazing rights in Iceland. And so in June, all of the farmers work together. They drive the sheep into the highlands. They pasture them up there. And then in September, they bring them down to these pens. And so these pens have come to represent this vernacular architecture that I've only been able to find in Iceland. And so they work together to drive all of the sheep into the main pen, the center pen, and then each farm has their individual sorting pens that they pull them all into. And I got to attend one several years ago, and it's just a big fun and game at this period. And as I thought about that, I really wanted students to experience that. And so I'm working on a study abroad for summer of 2026, where I've partnered with Sunshine Brazzi, and we are going to take students over. We're going to really combine this idea of folklore. I'm working with an adjunct professor at the university over there, and she has helped to arrange some things. We're going to do a walkabout, and then we're actually going to map one of the rétir because we have the ancient ones that are made out of lava. We have others, as the Danish came in, they shipped lumber in. So some are made out of lumber. Others are made out of concrete. So you can really tell the era of the rétir by that. But the Folklore Institute actually just got funding. It was so close to home for them that they didn't realize the value of it, that it really did belong to them. And they got funding to bring two students in to help us now really organize the photographs. My husband and I have traveled throughout the country photographing the ancient and the modern rétir. And so it's been fun to use my folklore lens and pair it with what they're doing and actually broaden it and make a connection between us and them.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I just want to follow up briefly. So, Lynn, Rosa was saying that it was so close to them. They didn't realize this was studyable. This was folklore, right?
So common, yeah. And that's, you know, so much of a university education is quite rightly dedicated to studying sort of the great works of human production, you know, whether that's literature, art, or in any other field. But we are just steeped in these other forms of equally meaningful and equally viable culture that are just so trivial and atmospheric that we tend not to look at them. And yet that's an enormous part of how we shape our cultural understandings of ourselves, of other people, of, you know, the people that we share our space with. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that this course and then other courses like it and the work that all of these amazing colleagues of mine are doing is sort of erasing that line and saying we don't need to set literature over here and folk culture over here. We can look at both of these as human expressions that help us understand the world around us. And it's a way for people to bridge that gap, to close that distance between them and this material that might seem sort of esoteric or unrelatable, and it suddenly brings it down to, oh no, I can connect with this. I understand this.
Well, let's turn to Deanna Allred. So I understand you joined these departments as a lecturer 2018, teach composition, grammar, farm literature and culture, introduction to fiction, understanding literature. And you believe learning is relational. Tell me about relational learning.
Well, I think we learn best in groups. And so I set my classrooms up that way where there's a lot of equity in the classroom. And with regards to farm lit, a couple years ago, I came across a book by Sharon Mitchler called Critical Rural Pedagogy. And in it, it shows you as an instructor how to elevate those rural voices and make their lived experiences more visible in the classroom. Because sometimes, because of stereotypes that rural folks might feel in the classroom, whether it's in our statewide campuses, because I teach online this course, I think sometimes we have students who are a little hesitant to bring their voices forward. And some of those stereotypes that Mitchler talks about, she has this great phrase, she calls it lack, lag, and rosy past. And she talks how rural folks sometimes feel like those stereotypes of lagging, if you live in a rural environment, there's something lagging or lacking, or we look at it as always having a rosy past. And when you can acknowledge those stereotypes and strip them away, it allows those student voices to come forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You teach composition pedagogy, folklore, reflective writing. Tell me about reflective writing.
Oh, all of my students have to write a weekly reflective takeaway about what they learned this week.
This is about what they learned. Okay,
yeah. And what they experienced and how what we learned this week connects with their broader life. Mm-hmm. I think that's how we learn, is when we can make those connections with not only what we're learning in class, but how does that connect to your other classes? How does that connect to your broader life?
Yeah.
You remember those takeaways.
Yes. Yeah, let me ask you about that. You're a former student of Deanna Allred.
Yeah, so I took the farm and literature class. I want to say it was also two summers ago. And it was just, I remember I messaged Deanna the summer or so after taking the class, and I found Braiding Sweetgrass, and that was one of the ones I really connected with, because at the time I took the course, my grandmother just passed away. We were trying to figure out how to sort of deal with the family farm. We had just all been kind of like, hey, who wants to essentially acquire it? And I was writing a lot about that in all my reflections about how my grandfather, when we were talking about folklore, I told a story about how my grandfather, he like burnt the farm down. We don't know if it was intentional or unintentional, but he didn't want the farm, and we talk about that still. And then none of the people really in my family wanted it, and so I was writing a lot about that, because this class helped me to really process both my grief and also come to terms with sort of my own rurality, where I was coming from as an individual, but also as a student and as someone who wanted to be a teacher. And it was like I had all these identities, and I was realizing I don't have to separate them. They work better when they're put in conjunction, really.
Mm-hmm. So I understand you're continuing your undergraduate research on rurality.
Yes. So kind of what Deanna was saying, I'm looking at it at like the secondary level, so high school 6 through 12, and I'm looking at how can we really get these high school students, because I was one of those students. I was a rural student, and I felt I was always pushed, go to college, do what you can to better yourself, and that's what education was for me. But there were also kids around me, and now that I'm student teaching, I'm in that weird in between of I'm an authority figure, but I'm not too far off from where these kids are, and they're just like, well, why graduate? Why go into college if I can go somewhere like NewCorp, you know, mm-hmm. and just start out at like $90,000 a year? And I'm like, that's what I was surrounded with growing up, and I want to show these students that the keywords I've been using are sort of the differences between a microscopic and a macroscopic world, and how you need to embrace both of those. You are a microscopic being in a macroscopic world, but that's important. That helps us to grow, and if you embrace your reality alongside this curriculum you're given, you're not only going to succeed if you decide to choose post-secondary education, but you're going to succeed just as an individual, even in your rural communities.
Yeah. I failed to introduce you. I just launched right in. This is Emily Folsom.
Hi.
So she's a senior at Utah State University, English with an emphasis secondary education, right?
Yes.
And UPR's digital administration intern.
Yes.
So let's turn to Lynn McNeil. I think our listeners probably know you pretty good.
Give a little pitch donating to Utah Public Radio if
great.
Needed.
That'd be great, yeah. Associate Professor of Folklore in the English Department, right? Chair of the Folklore Program.
Not anymore.
Oh, not anymore.
I once was. No, the wonderful Dr. Okay. Lisa Gabbard is now chair, and I am Lisa Director Gabbard of there. Graduate Studies.
Okay, so. Very good. Mm-hmm. Research Institute of Legend, Belief in Supernatural and Digital Culture. And I have you on periodically to push back on my neo-Luddite tendencies.
It's true, yes. I like to favor a balanced view of the role that technology plays in our lives.
Whenever I feel myself getting especially sour about mm-hmm. about the digital world, Lynn comes on and provides some positives for me. So co-editor of The Slender Man Is Coming, Creepypasta and Contemporary Legends on the Internet, author of the textbook Folklore Rules, and also co-editor of Legend Tripping.
Mm-hmm.
So a bunch of things there, and on television as well.
That's true. Yes, the History Channel and the Travel Channel mostly.
Yeah. I'm reading here you loved opening students' eyes to the unexpected role that folklore plays in our lived experiences.
Always. If I have an overall goal as an educator, as a researcher, it's to let people know, one, that folklore exists as an object worth studying, two, what makes it unique among the many other objects in the world worth studying, and how we can benefit from that, how any studies can benefit, kind of regardless of major or profession or interest or hobbies. There is a way that folklore will connect that will up the value mm-hmm. of that experience.
Could you think of an example of a student maybe, or someone off the top of your head who's had that aha moment under your tutelage?
You know, so the thing that I think I love the most is when a student from kind of far afield discovers a connection to folklore. A lot of our courses have been general education requirements in the university, so we get students from kind of all over the place. And I think one of my favorite unexpected connections is when business majors come in and discover the value of studying urban legend and rumor. And it's one of those things that you don't think about how significant the impact can be on sort of the economic bottom line for a company when a rumor begins about them or an urban legend about their product. And it's something that people try and capture intentionally with viral marketing. You want something to go viral, and then there's a very fine line between that and something going viral in a really bad way or taking off in a way you didn't expect. And so the work that folklorists have done to think about, okay, how do we negotiate the power that these things have in society becomes really essential if you are interested in marketing, for example. And that's just one of those ways that people discover folklore connecting in an arena they wouldn't have anticipated.
Hmm. Let's go to a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the farm in literature and culture course. And we are marking a decade of that course. We're talking with USU lecturers Bonnie Moore, Rosa Thornley, and Deanna Allred, also undergraduate student Emily Folsom, and with the USU Associate Professor of Folklore, Lynn McNeil. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are marking a decade of USU's Farm in Literature and Culture course. The class seeks to identify agriculture on literary themes that cut across human history and culture. And focuses also on music and folklore. And we're talking with the USU lecturers Bonnie Moore, Rosa Thornley, and Deanna Allred. We have with us USU Associate Professor of Folklore Lynn McNeil, and we have undergraduate student Emily Folsom. So let's turn to you, Bonnie. Tell us how this course began. You were there at the beginning, I guess? Yeah.
Well, I was a student in the beginning.
Oh, you were a student in the beginning. Okay.
Yeah. I took this course both as an undergrad and then later again as a grad student because I just connected with it so much and loved it so much. And it covers all the things that I care about, literature, folklore, lived experience. So I really love it for that reason. And music. I was going to be a music major, actually.
Tell me about the music component here.
Yeah, so there's a lot to talk about with music and the farm, and you wouldn't think so at first, but there are. And the first time that we talk about it in my course is when we talk about the slave narratives of farming under enslavement and how they used music to do the work. And it's interesting because all of the so-called, back in the day, Negro spirituals or African-American spirituals that we hear, almost all of them are on the pentatonic scale, which are the black notes on the piano, which is really interesting to me to think about and how that connects to the way they worked, the way they kept their spirits up, and the way they pushed back in a lot of ways. Music was very much used by them as a way to push back in the ways that they sang and the things they sang about. So we talk about that. Another connection is one of my former students was a music major, and he did his final project about the motifs that Dvorak used in his composing. And he talked about the Slavonic dances, the duets, and they were based on the motifs that were used by people in Czechoslovakia and Bohemia for those classical duets. And then also with the New World Symphony, he used small pieces of farm music from the United States to come up with the New World Symphony, which is a very well-known classical piece that you guys play, I think, pretty often.
Yes, a beautiful piece. Composed in the New World, right?
Right.
Here, he was over here. Tell me about the herbal garden.
So the herbal garden is a project I taught online, and it was in the summer, and I had a student who was African-American who lived in Price. She did, in her family experience, like tracing her family roots, she found out that her great-great-grandmother had been the physician for a plantation and had been over the herbs that were grown that she then used those herbs to take care of the sicknesses, not only of the slaves, but also of the owners of those, of the plantation. And so she decided to plant those same herbs and come up with her own herb garden. And so she was like, in some ways, recreating her great-great-grandmother's experience that way.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Well, let's turn to Rosa. Land-grant institutions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's an obvious connection there, right? Yeah.
Right, and that's actually a section of the book that Joyce and Evelyn included, which is significant because we all teach that section, but as my students have dived into it a little bit deeper this semester, the original editors of the book graciously contributed the profits of the book to a fund that our department held. And so when Brian McCuskey, our department head, came to us a year ago and said, we have this fund to support Farm Lit. What can we do? And he was the one, I'm going to give credit to him. He said, somehow let's celebrate a decade of Farm Lit. And so we've been brainstorming and this was one of the ideas, is that we do an exhibit with the special collections to represent land-grant institutions. And so I shifted a little bit in my course this semester, and my students have curated from a couple of digital databases that the special collections have. They've gone back to a database that has cyanotypes from the late, probably 20th century into the early 21st century. And I'm going to back that up. The one was 1896. So anyway, as they started looking at that, they had to dig a lot deeper into what the original purposes for the land-grant institution were, which was military sciences and agriculture and mechanical sciences. And they were looking for photographs about that. But some of the really fun things that happened was that as they were looking at and identifying some things, this goes back to what Lynn was saying earlier, they start to make personal connections to it. And it was fun for them to find photographs of when they were originally building Old Main. But a lot of the agricultural students that are in the class started to find old beef shows, and some of them found a map of the different extension offices and regional campuses. One of my students this semester, which was really fun to watch, they were paired up, and she and her partner were looking for photographs that represented irrigation. And when they started to research it, they realized that the irrigation photographs that they had found were actually from the experiment station. And as she began to research it more and more, she found that her grandfather, who had actually been, had led the experiment station for a while, had just files and files of his own of the experiment station. And so for her final project, she is doing a biography of her grandfather's history here at USU's experiment station, going through his slides. And the one thing that the students hope that visitors, and this will be on display during Ag Week in September. My students have curated it, and Paul Devon and Kelly will help us to put it together in September. But they really want other students to understand what it means to be a student at a land-grant university, because originally the purpose of the land-grant university was to educate the common folk. And that's why these other three areas were so critical, and the students have done a fantastic job to represent that with the Siena types that they've found.
Yeah, fascinating. Speaking of water master, my grandfather is water master out in Hinckley. And boy, he had stories. I think any water master has stories they can tell you.
That can be a scary profession.
Yes. It can. Yes, resort to violence often with water. Let me turn to Deanna. Talk about your students. You have an example of a nursing student?
Yeah, because I teach summer online, and it takes that 14-week class and condenses it into 7 weeks. So it is a very rigorous 7 weeks for these students. And it's summertime. And I often, like I said, get non-traditional students, especially from statewide. And some admin out there, bless them, in statewide, just recommends all of the nursing students to take that class because it offers two designations to graduation, a CI, a communications intensive, and a depth humanities. So out of 3 credits, you get 2 pathways to graduate. You get to check off 2 of your list. Anyway, so I have these nurses, and what I have found with these non-traditional students and more broadly statewide students is they connect very deeply with the reader, but they also connect deeply with Evelyn Funda's memoir Weeds and Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass in really unusual ways, and how that's evidenced is in their takeaways, their reflective writing at the end of the week, and also in their projects. And I find that I want my students to be able to connect what they're doing with what I'm trying to bring out in the class. So they try and connect with gardening and food deserts in rural spaces and how food affects our health. And I find that those projects that they complete at the end are very beneficial for them and their families, and they also have this rich literature that they've read throughout the semester. Mm-hmm.
So they pick it up as a easily acquired requirement, right? And then they find value in it. Right?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Tell me about your connection to Emily.
Emily was my student in a summer class. And after the class was over, she was an excellent student. And she did write a lot about weeds and her connection with her experience with losing a family farm, which was really at the same time my family was losing our family farm. And so I think that's a shared experience with many of us and with many of my students. And so we really did bond over that book like you do, and we bonded over our experiences in the class and with losing a family farm.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about that, Emily. So to backtrack, Evelyn Funda's book is in part about losing their family farm, right?
Yes. Yeah. And my family, it was an odd time. I was sort of, I guess you could say, a coming of age moment. My grandmother just passed away, like I said previously, and my family, we kind of, in a way, were, I guess, shunning our rural identities. And I very much growing up was like, I'm not taking ag classes, so I can't be considered a rural individual. But going through this experience of sort of acquiring, not acquiring that family farm made me realize, like, these are facets of me as an individual, and they're important facets, and it's something I need to embrace. Even if I'm not out there actively working on a farm, the way in which I communicate with my family, the way in which I communicate with the world, was very dependent on those rural experiences and growing up as a rural individual. And it just helped me realize, like, it felt... like I flourished more when I was able to embrace that and realize, hey, this is an important part of me. I might not actively, and Professor Deanna was always saying, everything is an agricultural act. And initially going into the course, I'm like, oh no, I have my own stereotypes. How am I ever going to be able to embrace that? But this, just all of that with my family, seemed to happen at such a perfect time to realize, yes, everything is an agricultural act, even if maybe you're not directly involved with agriculture in the more stereotypical ways.
Mm. You know, I have to hear more about that. Everything is an agricultural act.
Well, you kind of have to think that way when you teach this class. And I didn't take the class as an undergrad or a graduate, and I feel badly about that. But I was able to look at this class from maybe a little different perspective because I didn't have those other constraints on what anyone else had done. But I also have been very well tutored by the reader and by my friends that are here with me. And I feel like the agricultural eating is an agricultural act. I do think, I agree with Bonnie, it all goes back to agriculture. And here we are as Aggies. And I think we need to embrace that and celebrate it in our classrooms and in particular with this decade of FarmLit.
Similarly, having learned this, taking this class, tell me more about how that connects you to your family, right? To your ancestors.
Yes.
And then looking forward, how does this affect you looking forward?
Yeah. So I took the class again, and it was going through. And with my family, it's just it was kind of like we had our own stories. I would always ask my mom, what was it like growing up on a farm? And she's like, you would have hated it. But like, it was special hearing these stories because it instilled, you know, those, I worked hard. It's pushed me to work myself through education, not as like job training rather, but as this is an experience for me to better myself. And that's what as a rural student, education wasn't sort of pushed that way. But because of how my family saw education as an opportunity, like my mom, she grew up on the family farm and now she's a food scientist. She may not directly see that connection, or it might not be completely obvious at first glance, but she's still in some ways embracing her rural identities. And for me going forward, this undergraduate research I've been doing, I'm a secondary education major, so I'm going to teach high school. I want to show students like me who maybe would shy away initially or be confused about, okay, I'm rural, that's bad. It's not bad. It's a good thing. It gives me skills. It gives me individual traits that no other individual in the world is going to have. And I want to show my students, you should embrace that. you should full-heartedly realize, yes, I'm a rural student, but that gives me capabilities that no other person in this world is going to have. Mm. And I really want my students to be able to see the world that way, too.
Yeah. Tell me about the Undergraduate Research Fair.
Yes, so that is, it's a beautiful opportunity. That is where I'll actually be sharing my research I've been doing. It's a rurality, a post-secondary, and a secondary perspective. And this is just a lot of us undergraduate students, we get together, it's 2 days, I believe, and you just get to share your findings. You get to share in a professional, but also a little bit more low stakes environment, what you've been sort of, I like to call this my passion project. It's just something I feel deeply about, I connect with, and I get to share that with people. I get to share, and that's what literature, that's what research, everything sort of USU is about. It's we share our culture and we share it with others.
Mm, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's a great opportunity.
I know,
yeah.
I'm excited.
Yeah. So Lynn, anything else you'd like to say about the folklore component to this?
You know, my piece in this is so small compared to everyone who's been talking about this. I think what stands out to me and I think really is just the most beautiful thing about this course is, you know, it's been 10 years that this class is being offered, and it is so clear that the Farmlet class is like this living entity. It has the capacity to be so responsive to the students who take it. This is not a top-down teaching moment for all that. There's a reader designed by, you know, experts on these subjects. Each of you talking about the students who have veered the course in a different direction or added a component to how you went on to teach the course later really just shows this responsive, living thing that I don't think a scripted or static, you know, course is able to do. This has not been the same class over these 10 years. And what's shaped it and changed it is the students who take it as much as the instructors who teach it. And I feel like that really is the hallmark of a class that can connect with students. It's not simply a passive learning experience. It's this active shaping of the course you're in. And then the way that course goes on to be taught in the future, it is truly an inspirational thing to witness that in action.
Can I add to that? A week ago, I asked my students, what do you want people on Utah Public Radio to hear? And they talked about, again, back to this idea of land-grant institutions and when they really found out what an impact it had. They as a class, identify the questions that they want to use, the discussion questions on the literature. But what they wanted to discuss that week was how can we as students shift the institution of higher education from something we merely participate in to something we actively work to improve mm-hmm. and enlarge.
Yeah.
And if that class, this class, can do nothing but help them to really understand what it means to be civic-minded, we've done our job. And I think that comes back to the very roots of farming in America. We go back to, you know, Jefferson and Jefferson's letters. And, you know, he was an agriculturist first. He preferred being an agriculturist over being the president of the United States. But it's that kind of civic-mindedness that students gain from getting back to the roots, the simpler way of living.
And I think all of us have had this experience where a student will say, this is not what I expected
exactly.
when I enrolled in Farmlet.
Yes.
And so you ask that, well, what did you expect? And they'll say, not really sure. Or I was going to read
Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath, yeah. And it's like, oh, no, we did far more than that. And so their takeaways are so deep and rich. And I love the what you say about civic. They do come away more civically minded and with a greater investment in community and in agriculture.
Mm. Absolutely, because they know that they have a voice in it and that they matter and their experience matters as a rural person or as a city person. It doesn't matter. We all connect to agriculture in one way or another, and it's so fun for them to see that light come on, and they come up and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize you know, I just saw this or I just saw that. I got a text from a student just about a week ago. It was a license plate that said, "Douse for you, a water witching," right? And they said, and this, I hadn't had the student for 3 years.
Yeah.
And they still think about the class. So that says something.
That does say something, yeah. 30 seconds. Emily, we'll give you the last word. What do you want to listeners to take away?
Just this class will change your life. I was going into it not knowing what to expect. I was teased and I was told, "Hey, you're just taking a class about the farm," just like, you know, yeehaw, kind of, you know.
Yeehaw.
Yeah. Yep. But it changed my life. As cheesy as that sounds, it truly did.
All right, wonderful. Well, we've been talking, we're marking a decade of USU's Farm and Literature and Culture course, and we've been talking with the USU lecturers Bonnie Moore, Rosa Thornley, and Deanna Allred, also USU Associate Professor of Folklore Lynn McNeil, and undergraduate student Emily Folsom. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
As the birds are chirping outside and the radio is playing, it's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. As I went outside after dusk on March 30th, I got a surprise as I looked west in the off and on clouds and saw a little fingernail of a moon in the west, not far above the horizon. It was sublime and on the bottom. Captivated, I walked through my neighborhood trying to watch it as long as possible, knowing Luna would set soon in the west. And according to the Salt Lake Astronomical Society website and subsequent research from Space and Telescope, something called Earthshine mornings happens about now. This is where the unlit part of the moon becomes visible, also known as the Da Vinci glow. Earthshine, the dim glow visible on the unlit part of a slim crescent moon, is the reflection of Earth's light on the moon. It is visible for a few days before and after a new moon, so you'll get another chance. When the moon is in its crescent phase, so if you missed it the first time, look again. The new moon happened on March 29th, so the Earthshine was visible from March 31st to around April 2nd on the unlit part of the waxing crescent moon. And now that it's after the 2nd, watch the moon wax or grow each night, getting higher in the west as Bella Luna visits all kinds of orbs, till it grows to the full on the 12th when the moon and blue spica almost touch in the early evening. And in between, something to look for on the 5th of April, the half moon hangs near Mars and the Gemini twins to the upper left. And jumping down from a 9-month visit to the only International Space Station we have, can we please keep it? As Crew 9, NASA astronauts Sonny Williams, Butch Willmore, Nick Hague, and Alexander Gurbanov of Roscosmos splash down in the Gulf of Mexico, coming down from the space station, splashing into the ocean off the coast of Tallahassee, Florida, a fleet of recovery vessels soon converged on Crew 9's Dragon capsule. They discovered that some curious marine mammals were already there, checking out this strange object that fell from the sky into their ocean home. Just after hitting the water on Tuesday, March 18th, engineer Kate Tice said, "Wow, we got a little pod of dolphins, not just one or two." You can see the photo from NASA on the Skywatcher Facebook page. In fact, see two or three photos of dolphins and how you can find that in the sky. Dolphins and whales sing and communicate on sometimes very high and different frequencies. That, hey, someone said that maybe they communicate with entities in outer space, and they already do with us, and when we pay attention, especially. Maybe we can learn to communicate some more as we have our ocean-dwelling entities who greet us, smile, laugh with us, and probably at us. There are many stories of dolphins guiding ships through storms and helping people in distress in the seas. One of many incidents was in Japan in 1964. After a fishing boat sank, a group of dolphins helped save the lives of 4 crew members by keeping them afloat until help arrived. And since it is one sky, many cultures, and our little greeting pod of friendly dolphins visited our outer space dwellers coming back from the space station, let's go into the oceans and above into the sky just a little bit. Talk on high frequencies about the constellation Delphinus the dolphin. Many cultures see many things with this little diamond-shaped asterism, but one of my favorites, of course, is the dolphin. And in modern times, it kind of looks like a traditional UFO by some. I like to think Delphinus leaps in and out of the Milky Way on magical summer nights above our heads, but you can still see the apex lozenge diamond that lies in that region off the sky, already alluded to as the sea. And nearby are the other maritime creatures in the sky, the fishes, the sea goat, and the whale. You can find Delphinus with your naked eyes at a national park now near you. Or just be creative and find a dark spot behind a pine tree and look west for Altair in Aquila the Eagle with your binoculars. And As we marvel over the moon, our closest neighbor in space, NASA continues to prepare the Artemis II mission that will fire out to orbit the moon with astronauts on board in the next year. As progress continues, the core stage of NASA's space launch system is now integrated with the rocket's twin boosters. Technicians at Kennedy Space Center in Florida move the core stage for NASA's second stage launch system rocket into position between the vehicle's two solid-fueled boosters. Working inside the iconic 52-story tall vehicle assembly building, ground teams used heavy-duty cranes to first lift the butterscotch orange core stage from its cradle into the VAB's cavernous transfer aisle. You can see the NASA photos on the SkyWatcher Facebook page. After more preparation, ground crews lowered the rocket between the Space Launch System's twin solid rocket boosters already stacked on a mobile launch platform inside High Bay 3, where NASA assembled space shuttles and Saturn V moon rockets for those Apollo missions. Engineers will stack a cone-shaped adapter on top of the core stage, followed by the rocket's upper stage adapter ring, and finally the Orion spacecraft that will be home to four-person Artemis II crew for the 10-day journey through deep space. This will be the first crewed flight of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to land astronauts on the lunar South Pole and eventually build a sustainable human presence on the moon, with an eye toward expeditions to Mars in the future. So keep the faith in our good intentions as people. Write your congressman. Look at science. Keep looking up, look around, and get lost. Skywatcher Leo T.